The serve, sliced, backhand return. Rafa with a backhand volley, and it's over. Game, set, and match. His third U.S. Open Men's Singles Championship.
Sloan from deep beyond the baseline plays a backhand. Keys a forehand. Sloan just hammering away. Now steps into a forehand. It hangs over. Forehand netted by Keys, and Sloan Stephens is the 2017 U.S. Open champion. A warm hug at the net between the two friends.
Here comes a big smile with Sloan. She can't believe it.
Welcome to Courtside, the official podcast of the U.S. Open. I'm Steve Flink, and I'd like to welcome to this podcast a woman who has always been much larger than the game she played for a living. Billie Jean King established herself as one of the greatest tennis players of all time, capturing 12 majors in singles, including all four of the majors at least once. She took 39 Grand Slam titles altogether in singles, women's doubles, and mixed. Her career stretched from the late 50s in the amateur years into the early 80s professionally. Billie Jean was a champion through and through, but her enduring importance transcends what she did on the court. She was the leading player among the original nine who signed $1 contracts with Gladys Heldman in 1970, and she was instrumental in establishing a women's tour that became full-fledged the following year. She became the first president of the Women's Tennis Association in 1973, the same year she defeated Bobby Riggs in the renowned Battle of the Sexes. And then Billie Jean founded World Team Tennis with her husband Larry King in 1974. In 2006, the U.S. Open facility was fittingly renamed the USTA Billie Jean King National Tennis Center, and that was one of her many high honors. Thanks, Billie Jean, for joining me on this podcast, honoring the 50th anniversary of Open Tennis and the U.S. Open.
I'm very excited because I was alive 50 years ago, so I experienced it.
Well, Billie Jean, with half a century passing since that first Open of 68, and you had, of course, won the Nationals the year before, all-amateur event at that time at Forest Hills. Now you come back in 68. Trying to win the title again, and you lost in the finals to Virginia Wade. What's your recollection of that match and that inaugural U.S. Open?
My recollection is that I was up late with three sets. I think I had three sets against Maria Bueno. It might have even rained a little. I had to go on and off. I can't remember exactly, but it was a long, long match. And the next day, Virginia just played too well. I mean, it's like no excuses, right? When you lose. If you win, you can have all the excuses you want. But no, Virginia won. But I was so thrilled for Arthur because he won, Arthur Ashe.
Yes.
Beating Auker in five sets.
Yep.
And his dad was there. And, oh, my God, I just loved it. I thought it was so perfect for Arthur to win. And it was great for Virginia because I won Wimbledon in her home country. And then she won the U.S. Open in my home country. So I'm sure she would have... She was thrilled that she won the U.S. Open.
Well, you know, we interviewed her.
It's a thrill to win. It's a thrill.
We spoke to her earlier in the year, and she seems to feel about it sort of the way you did. She felt like she was in the zone that day.
No, she really played too well. I think it was like 2-3, or it was really quick.
Yeah, 4-2.
All I know is I kind of blinked, and I was at the net shaking hands with her. Like, what happened?
Yeah. Well, I guess those are not as tough to absorb as losing close, hard fought finals because you just
the close ones are the ones that never get really bother you a lot.
So, Billie Jean, it wasn't that far into the Open era when you really started dominating. You had some of your most dominant years and some of your best Opens because you won in that period from 71 through 74. Those four Opens, you won three of them. And it seemed that the grass at Forest Hills, well, maybe, I don't know how you felt about the grass there versus Wimbledon, but it certainly suited your attacking game, and you're a great serve and volleyer, and you really took advantage of the conditions to the hilt. Would you say that looking back on 71 and 72, that when, of course, you became the first woman to earn $100,000 or more in 71, that period, was that, in your mind, your peak tennis, and it was reflected at the Open?
I think probably 71, 72 are my probably best years because I had to work around knee operations all the time. So I have to think about when did I have my knee operation. It always took me a long time to rehabilitate and recuperate. We didn't have any of the knowledge we have today. What I had would have been very easy to take care of today. Tomalacia would have been easy peasy. But it was it got in the way, definitely. But what got in the way the most of not knowing how good I could be is the politics and trying to create a professional tennis. Chris Everett and I talk about this all the time. She's so sweet to me. She always goes, "Oh my gosh, you could have won so many more titles. People have no idea." You know, she's very nice to me about that. But you know, always having meetings, trying to go to sponsor meetings, getting sponsorship. I have two great feelings about the U.S. Open. First of all, I loved the fact we had open tennis in 68. I had fought for that. I got in trouble because of it. But we finally had all the best players playing at Forest Hills at the U.S. Open. So I was thrilled. And then we didn't get equal prize money. The women were making, I don't know, was it 30%, 35%? And we really wanted to have equal prize money. It's just important to have equality for all of us. And if it had been reversed, if the men had been at 30%, I would have been fighting for them like crazy because that's just the right thing to do. And the great thing about tennis is you have a platform. And because of professional tennis, it was growing in interest. Television, all the best players could play together for the first time, like the Rod Labors of the world that had to skip 5 years in the 60s as a contract pro. Jack Kramer's tour probably helped us go to professional or open tennis because he took all the best guys away. They didn't really care about the women, so the top women were always competing at the tournaments like forever. But I just thought it was important to be professional because I grew up in team sports, and to be a pro meant you were good, like really good. And as an amateur, it meant you weren't as good. So as a child growing up in basketball, football, baseball, all the team sports, I always thought, I want to be a pro. So finally, I could actually say I'm a pro. Well, in fact, I had a little child come up to me and go, "Hey, lady, are you pro?" That was one of the greatest feelings in my life to say, "Yes, I am."
Absolutely, you were able to really wear that label proudly in the early '70s there when you were playing.
Yeah, he was so sweet. Yeah, because we actually were getting paid under the table, and finally, we had integrity in our sport.
So
1968 was really important. So we had integrity in our sport because we played for prize money now, and everybody just went out and played, and we made money by performance, which was fantastic in those early years.
Well, Billie Jean, speaking of performances, I'd love you to talk a little bit about the match with Chrissy in 71, which was a very important one in many ways. I know you've spoken about it before, but that was in the semifinal, she'd had the spectacular run at 16 all the way to the penultimate round. So you had a lot of pressure on you when you played her in the semis.
Yeah, I did. And I know people probably don't realize it, but Chrissy, she likes to call Chrissy, was still an amateur, and her parents wouldn't let her play on our slim circuit. And she was still in high school anyway, but Jimmy, her dad, Coach Jimmy, did not want her to play. So it was about killing us because we were trying to make a pro tour for her generation and the generations to come. They were going to be the ones that would derive the most out of what we were trying to do. So it was really tough. And I knew Chrissy was the next superstar, and she and I got along great. We got along great from day one, and I liked her a lot. I thought we come from similar backgrounds in the way our parents think and feel about values, and we can have great talks. And I actually got angry with the women and actually had a meeting because they weren't saying hello to her, they weren't being hospitable, and we're the older ones. That's our job. You know, as a group. And so I called an emergency meeting, and this was around the quarterfinals, and I said, "This has to stop. We have to be good to each other, and we have to be even better to the young kids coming up, because they're our future. And what do you think we're fighting for? We're fighting for them anyway." And I said, "I know, Chris. I don't think you've been good to her. It's our job to always say hello, how are you, period. Okay, and be welcoming to everyone." And so I said, first of all, she's the next superstar. She is the superstar, and any moment she's going to be the superstar. So you understand that she is money for you, too. She'll put money in your pockets as well. That's not the point. We've started this so it would prosper. And because of Chris, we're guaranteed to prosper. She is going to be phenomenal. This is just the beginning. So I said, let's stop, put things aside, start over, and be good to her. And if you don't like it, then beat her in the match so we don't have to deal with this right now. But eventually, she will play. We just have to be calm with this and have a long-term look at it. So anyway, they walked up. They said, you're right. We've got to be better person than that. And so they were. So when I was going to play Chris, everything in my mind was about, if I lose, they're going to say, we're not going to support the pro tour. We don't think you guys are any good. And amateur tennis is actually better than pro tennis. And all these things were going around at that time. So I actually, it's the only time I've ever cried in my whole life, I think before or after a match. And I cried in the shower. I sobbed in the shower before I played Chris. Because I knew what was on the line. I knew I had to beat her or else we were not going to be in good shape from a media point of view at all. And to get new owners for new tournaments. We were very young still. We were trying to get new tournaments. It's a very high-risk thing to ask people to do. So this is it. That was my moment of truth in my, not so much, I didn't feel in my career on the court probably, but what we're trying to accomplish off the court and for the future generations, and even for her, I need to beat her because I did not want professional tennis for women to go away. The Virginia Slams had just started in 1971, and this is September of 1971. It was a very monumental moment, and I cannot tell you what relief I had in my heart and soul when that match was over and we're shaking hands with the net. And she and I got along great. If you see the press conference after that match, you'll see how great it was, but how the media would not talk to her. I kept saying, you got to ask her some questions. Ask Chris, I wanted her to start understanding the media as well. You know, it's our job as an older generation to mentor and help the younger generation. But I knew she was going to be a superstar, and she was going to have to face so many media the rest of her life. It was a done deal. So I knew she was the superstar, the rising superstar.
So, Billie Jean, you didn't have a letdown. You went on and won that final. And then the next year, probably that was the most dominant year you had at Forest Hills, and you knocked off Wade and Margaret Court and Kerry Melville and all in straight sets. 72, I mean, we talked about your peak, but I would say if you had to pinpoint it, that really was the year, even more than 71 when you played your finest tennis.
I think 72 was probably my best year. We were playing the Virginia Slims of San Francisco during the Australian 72, but I won all the other three.
Yes.
So maybe that year I could have won the a Grand Slam, but I'll never know because I didn't go, and I thought it was much more important to be playing the Virginia Slim Series Tour than it was to be going to majors. We were trying to do something very special. And even Chris later, Martina, all of us missed a lot of majors. We were really trying to make professional tennis happen. But we were all playing the Virginia Slims of San Francisco during the Australian.
Yeah,
so
that's
people have to understand that we thought that was more important than winning major titles. And they put so much emphasis on major titles. But for my generation, and the generations before me, especially for the men, especially just the men, really, that wasn't fair because someone like Rod Laver missed 20 majors, and he had 11 majors without playing those 5 years, probably his best year. So yeah. I don't like it when they talk about Grand Slams, and this one has more. Like Chris and Martina definitely would have had more than 24 singles if they hadn't given up a lot.
No doubt about it. But Billie Jean, let's talk a little bit now about Yvonne Goolagong, because to me, that 1974 final at Forest Hills, and I've talked to you about this match before, and I know it. I think it meant a lot to you. It was some of the most spectacular shot making and some of the greatest audience reaction I've ever heard at a major final. The crowd was gasping during the points. They were really exhilarated by what they were witnessing, and you came from behind to win that match 7-5 in the third. Talk about that victory in the context of your career and how you managed to fend off Yvonne on a day when she was enormously inspired.
Well, Yvonne was another one after Chris got going, and then Martina showed and Yvonne showed up. We knew we had really, I was really thrilled. We had some great superstars in our sport with those three. Yvonne was so natural, always the crowd's favorite because she's so balletic and smooth. But we're both quick, very quick. the courts had divots in it, and they'd actually put the divots back in the court, and they sprayed it with green spray paint, you know, out of a can.
Yes, yes.
And if we put our foot in on that, it would come. It, first of all, it'd come up, but it would get sticky on the bottom of our feet. So I can tell you, we had a lot going on that day. I almost did not play the U.S. Open that year because we just started World Team Tennis.
Right.
And I was the player coach for the Philadelphia Freedoms, and we played 3 months, and I was exhausted, and I thought, you know, I don't know if I need to play the Open. So I almost didn't enter. I entered at the last second.
What changed your mind?
I probably got a little rest for a moment, whatever the deadline was. And I thought, I don't want to have any regrets later that I didn't play in my own country's tournament. You know, the title of the U.S. Open, U.S., I'm an American. I'm very, you know, much for my country. I love playing Fed Cup, representing my country. I love it. I think I would rather do that than anything. So, you know, I like team situations anyway. But when you're an American, you want to play in your own country's championships. So I think that's probably why, because I don't want to have any regrets, and it's my country. And I think it was important that I do play, because I am an American. And I just played Riggs the year before. Oh my God, a lot happened. A lot was going on.
And the start of the WTA the year before also, the presidency.
Thank you. Start of the WTA, and I actually have a story in 72 if we have time for this podcast, how we got equal prize money. But the 74 match, I remember not remembering much, just trying my guts out. And I remember these great rallies. We had lobs, we ran back up the lobs, hit it, continued the rallies, went up the net, went back and forth. On this court, that quite frankly, the bounces were shocking. they were tough. And then your shoes get all sticky from the green when you hit that green patch of spray.
You were down 3-love. You were down 3-love, only one break, but down 3-love in the third.
And what happened? Was she ahead 5-something at all?
No. Then you got back to 4-all. You broke her. You served for the match, and she played an amazing game to break back. And then from 5-all, you lost 1 point in the last 2 games and closed it out.
Steve Flink, what would we do without you? I wouldn't even know what I did without you. I'm not kidding. You're amazing how you know all this about so many matches. Anyway, I just felt like a guardian angel had come down and helped me. All I can remember is shaking hands at net and realizing that I'd won. I couldn't believe it.
And do you remember telling Vic Edwards, Yvonne's coach, that didn't you basically tell him you couldn't believe you won that match?
Yes, I still can't. I still don't know how I won that match. I guess I was in the zone. It sounds like it. I can't remember anything. You know how you just get in the zone? That's when you play your best, when you're in the now and in the moment. And I must tell you, when you play team tennis and then you go play a tournament, you're much tougher because you have to concentrate so much faster. There's no breathing room at all in team tennis. And what I did after team tennis, I played every match like team tennis. I take one set at a time, so to speak, and break it up in smaller segments instead of a match. I started thinking more in one ball at a time always, but like sets. You know, I don't know how to explain it. It just helped me. It helped me. I just wish I'd been a little younger. It was a real thrill for me to win, and I knew, if you're lucky to ever win anything, even one, that by now, by 74, I was really fortunate and been blessed to have won as much as I had. But most importantly for me, we were on our way with our Virginia Slams tour. And, you know, those things all help you. Help me as somebody had to lead off the court. I knew how important that was psychologically. It let me breathe is what it did. It let me breathe, you know, inhale, exhale. I mean, even in 72, we said we wouldn't play the next year. If you look at old clippings, you'll see where I said, I'm not going to play next year. And I'm going to be talking to the girls about not playing next year if we don't get equal prize money. So what I did is I went around to people I knew, like Joe Coleman, who was chairman of Philip Morris. I went to Marvin Koslow, who worked at Bristol Myers. I said, you know, I'm going to go talk to Billy Talbot about equal prize money next year. And I said, I want to take something to give them, not just be begging or asking. So we put our heads together, and they said, well, we'll make up the difference in the prize money. I said, you will? I said, well, if I can go in with that, then I'm not just asking for them to give something up. We're actually helping them do this. And then also Cece Martinez, who was a player in those days, she and Ismay Emanuel passed out a survey to the fans at Forest Hills and asked them about women's tennis, and it came back much more favorably than we thought it was, and I showed that to Billy Talbot as well. So I had old-fashioned data, and then I said we're willing to make up the difference thanks to Bristol Myers, because I think it was Van Dielder. I think they finally did the difference. And he said, "You're kidding, right?" Billy Talbot, I love Billy Talbot anyway. He was a type 1 diabetic. He was a great champion, and he was a tournament director. And we met one-on-one. There's a little shack at Forest Hills where he could just watch the courts as tournament director. You can only get about two people in there. And he and I sat in these chairs and looking at each other and really up close. And that's where that negotiation went on, and I'll never forget it. And he was really great about it. And I thought the board had passed it, the USTA board. But I went and tried to find the minutes in 1973, and they said it's not in the minutes. So Billy Talbot, on his own, must have done it and convinced them we're doing this.
I bet he did.
Yeah, he had to in those days. In those days, it's not as formal probably as it is now. So thank you to Billy Talbot. That's why we have equal prize money. Thank you to Bristol Myers. Thank you to Joe Coleman. I mean, it takes a lot of people to make things happen.
So, Billie Jean, after that, though,
I have great memories of the U.S. Open and all this.
Yeah, but after that match with Yvonne, Billie Jean, you played a few more times, played it three more times there later in your 30s, and you even made the semis in 79 on the hard courts at Flushing Meadows. What did you think of that transition? Because I know you had very fond feelings about Forest Hills and sitting at the clubhouse dusk.
I love Forest Hills, but I must tell you, in 1974, when we were having the ceremony, it was standing room only. There were people sitting on the grass. The stadium was packed, standing room only. They had boxes in the back. They had people physically sitting on the grass. I know Breshnikov, I think, was there that day, too, so I was excited. And I thought to myself when I was receiving the award that we're going to have to move. It's just too crowded here now. The parking isn't there. There's no space. There's no real locker room for us. You know, we had to change where the members are. Now, the men's locker room is a different story, which I just saw for the first time. That was huge. The ours was tiny. And I knew then we were going to have to eventually move because we're just outgrowing ourselves thanks to professional tennis, thanks to television. Sport was growing so much, especially after I played the ribs. You couldn't get on a tennis court, which is a great sign. But you could tell that for the first time we were bulging at Westside. And I knew then the light bulb went on, and I went, "Oh, Bob, you know, we're going to have to move."
And how do you feel about, in retrospect now, that the transition of Flushing, the differences, and what the event has become at Flushing Meadows ever since 1978 when the move occurred?
Oh, I think it's amazing what's happened. First of all, it's more accommodating for the fan, which is what you always want to worry about. There's times I miss Westside, and I love that horseshoe. I love watching Stranger on a train, which is a Albert Hitchcock movie that's all done at Forest Hills. I still watch it once in a while and I feel nostalgic. No, I think what's happened at the Open today is amazing, with more courts, more food, more statues, more history. I just think it's very New York. It's very open. It's very kind of rowdy, which I think that's what New York is. It's got a lot of cultures. I think it's much more international because our sport has totally grown over the years. And that's reflected in the audience and holding up flags and the chanting that goes on. And they're constantly refurbishing and they're constantly making the place better for the audience. They're always improving. They have, you know, extra courts now that that really have great seats. And, of course, it's got my name on it. So,
well,
let's
talk about that, Billie Jean. Obviously the naming of the Arthur Ashe Stadium was a very bold and popular move. I remember Judy Levering.
That was
great in 97. Go ahead.
But Judy Levering was fantastic. She just loved Arthur and she made that happen. And that was a great night in 1997 when the Parade of Champions were there. I think Arlen Kantarian should also get a lot of credit. He came from Radio City, and he understood entertainment. He totally upgraded us as an entertainment package compared to the old days. That night that Arthur Ashe, I think John McEnroe spoke, and Jeannie Ashe was wonderful. And I just, the only person I really missed there that night was Althea Gibson. I was hoping she was going to come that night. She didn't make it. So
now, what about your night? Let's talk about your night now. That was a great night to honor Arthur and name the stadium after him, fully deserved. But in 2006, the whole facility was renamed the USTA Billie Jean King National Tennis Center. And I remember seeing you during that ceremony when Chrissy Everett spoke and Jimmy Connors and Venus Williams and Mary Carrillo emceed. It was a remarkable occasion. And you were kind of holding your head at times as if you could still not quite grasp what had happened. Is that true?
I still can't grasp it. I don't really understand. When I walk in and somebody goes, look at your name. I go, oh gosh, okay. So I look up for them and I look up and I feel responsibility. I feel that I've been so blessed. I never would have dreamed I'd ever have that happen to me. And I really thank the board, and I thank Franklin Johnson. I guess he was the president. He also was from Southern California. I'm sure he was instrumental. But it took a lot of people behind the scenes to make that decision. And it made me feel good because I felt like the USTA and I had come full circle because we've been through a lot together, both good and bad. And so that was really a good feeling that day. And my mother was there, and Ilana, my partner, my nieces and their husbands were there. That was very important to me. I know my brother was so excited because, you know, Randy Moffitt played 12 years of professional baseball, most of them with the San Francisco Giants. He was so happy for me because we always grew up in our sports and supported each other. And I don't know, it was an amazing night, and Mayor Bloomberg was there, and I think Arlen probably had something to do with it too, and he was there, and of course Barry and Chris, Jimmy Connors and McEnroe, John. I was just really pleased that those particular players were there, and I love it. You know, Venus is so sweet, and Chris was so sweet. I don't know. I'm just really lucky to have the players get up there and speak like that and be honored. And then I want, when people go by this facility, I want them to look at it as a beacon of hope. I want them to think about what you can do not only on the court or in your own field of endeavor, but what you can do off, that we're all given blessings, and just find out what they are and what are you good at. You know, I always ask kids, what are you good at? Because it's a blessing, and so how can you use it to make the world a better place? So those are the feelings I have, and I was really thrilled that we certainly had come a long way, like the Virginia Swim slogan, we've come a long way for our sport, and for, I think we have made the world a better place. And I think that facility is also a public park, and I'm a public park kid, and I think that's important. And I remind people all the time it's a public park, and they don't realize it. So I hope everyone understands that that's why we're there, too. I think that makes a big difference. It's open to everyone.
So, Billie Jean, as we close this podcast and look back, celebrate this 50th anniversary, clarify, if you can, how you feel about the growth and evolution of the U.S. Open over these past 50 years and what you believe have been your most lasting contributions to the tournament, because you've made many.
I don't know, Steve. I don't even think about it. I don't know. I just think it's just been such a team effort by everyone. Everybody, you know, whether you're a coach, whether you're a parent, whether you're a grandparent, whether you're a kid just starting in your neighborhood, or I always, when I think of that U.S. Open, I think that belongs to everyone. That's what it's about. It's like we're welcoming all of you. We want all of you to come out and love the tennis and be inspired by it and share in it, because we are in entertainment. And I think that's something that I don't know what the players feel, but they have to understand that we're entertainers. We're there for the people. The people aren't there for us. And I think sometimes we forget. So I think that's really important, and we owe it to give it everything we have and to share the experience with those people watching. And hopefully they'll be inspired to have a voice, to be the best they can be, whatever they do in their life. And hopefully we inspire some future tennis players versatile, because every generation we need great players to keep inspiring the next generations. And right now I'd like us to have a male player that is in the, you know, top two or three, and we don't. So that's one of my prayers. And we've been very lucky to have Venus and Serena. They've transcended our sport and continue to do so, and I know they're going to do even better, greater things when they retire and finish the sport. But I think the great thing is the draw is big. There's qualifying. There's other tournaments, you like the juniors, the national juniors. If you do well there, you also either get a wild card or get in qualifying or straight into the draw. So that's more inclusive. We just have so many aspects to our sport, and it culminates at the U.S. Open. The one thing I'd like people to understand, which they really don't, even the players don't know this thing, I go, what does open tennis mean? And all you do is hear dead silent. I said, it means it's the first year we got prize money. So everybody out there listening, that's the first year that we were professionals. We actually got a check instead of a per diem or whatever as an amateur. And I am telling you, people do not understand what that means. So that's what that means. Open tennis means first time we got a check. I think that's important to understand our history, because the more you know about history, the more you know about yourself, and the more you can shape the future.
Well, Billie Jean, you've been a crucial figure in the history of the game, and you have certainly shaped it immeasurably. And I thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today.
Thanks a lot. I really appreciate it. I'm so glad you're doing this to celebrate the 50th anniversary of open tennis.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun. We've enjoyed it and we've spoken
to. You're a big part of it, Steve. And the media has been really good to us, especially the traditional media through the years, because they told our story.
Well, thank you very much, Billie Jean. Look forward to catching up at the Open.
All right. Take care.
You too. Thanks for listening to Courtside, the official podcast of the U.S. Open. I'm Steve Flink. Qualifying week is upon us. We hope you enjoy the 2018 U.S. Open, and thank you for listening all year to our celebration of 50 years of the U.S. Open.